From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Massachusetts Representative Catherine Clark joins us to talk about Syria, gun control, and her view of the 2018 midterms. Also, a major criminal justice reform bill passes in the Massachusetts State House. It includes significant changes to mandatory minimum sentencing.
It is a sea change, really, in the way people are seeing the difference between those people who are suffering from addiction and those who are actually profiting.
All that and hats, gloves, and winter coats aside, it's opening day at Fenway Park. We'll check in. That's next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're going to start with the latest in our series of conversations with members of the Massachusetts congressional delegation. Today, it's the Massachusetts 5th, and we're joined in the studio now by Congresswoman Catherine Clark. Congresswoman Clark, it's so great to see you. Thank you so much for coming in.
Oh, it is such a pleasure to be here, Megan.
So there is a lot for us to discuss, as always. I just wanted to start off with a trip that you recently returned from. You were in Israel and Jordan, right? Where the delegation visit was focused on regional security and cooperation. So what kind of things did you hear there?
So we also were able to go to Afghanistan trip as well. And we were really focused on hearing what is happening right now. Where are we in the peace process? Where is the commitment to the two-state solution and to human rights?
And did you hear optimism there? Because I haven't heard optimism about that in a while.
There wasn't a lot of optimism coming out of these meetings, I regret to report. But I think it was important that we went. We met with the King of Jordan. We met with Prime Minister Netanyahu, Ambassador Friedman, and many people who are working and living in Israel, and lots of Palestinians as well. And the message that we delivered was Israel is our ally. It is a strong democracy in a very dangerous neighborhood, but we also want to see that commitment to a two-state solution, and that we believe that the security of Israel is best served by coming to a peaceful negotiation.
Okay, so and you, this was the message that you imparted to Prime Minister Netanyahu?
It was.
How did he respond to that? Because he sees, you know, in President Trump a strong ally, and it was after the election of President Trump that the idea of a two-state solution seemed to start withering away.
Yeah, and you know, we really talked to him about our commitment to it, how we can be helpful, how he sees the future of security in Israel. You know, the United States has been there. We're a strong supporter of Israel. He acknowledged that and was grateful for the support that has been given. But we were really saying to him, from very specifically around African asylum seekers issue that we raised with him, to more broadly on how we can move this peace process forward and become re-engaged again.
And then what did Prime Minister Netanyahu say to you in response to those things?
You know, I found that he is very focused on Iran and what is happening there. And it was hard to get him to talk about where he wanted to be with the peace process. And what we are trying to prevent is sort of having this new, the new status that we are currently seeing between Israel and the Palestinian Authority be the new peace. And that we have to really keep working and make sure that as the United States, we are pushing towards an actual two-state solution, which is harder to do under this administration. But I think we need to keep bringing that message that as a firm ally of Israel, we are watching and will continue to push for that.
Okay. So the Middle East being what it is, we could actually spend our entire time together about it. But there's a lot of other things to discuss. But before we leave the region entirely, I was just wondering what you think about President Trump's Trump's recent comments about possibly pulling U.S. troops out of Syria.
Yeah, we spent a lot of time on this trip asking people to reflect on lessons learned out of Iraq. Mm. And especially as we're, everybody wants a way to bring our troops home from Syria, from Iraq, from Afghanistan, where we visited. But how do we do that and ensure that we keep security in the region, that American interests are protected as well? And I think that is a balance. I'm glad to see that the president is sort of backed off a little and committed to a timeline after advice from his those who are looking at Syria on the ground and saying, we don't want to pull out too hastily. So I hope that he will continue to evolve and look at what are the real security issues for the Syrian people, and that we don't pull out of there and perhaps tip the balance on what's a very precarious and dangerous situation.
So you were also in Afghanistan as well.
Yes.
Okay. So again, we're spending a lot of time on foreign policy, but these are big issues.
Yeah.
I mean, the United States has been in Afghanistan we're on year 16.
Yeah.
Now, 16 years. It's the longest continuous military engagement the United States has been involved in ever, practically. What did you see?
There was actually some room for optimism.
Okay.
As far as, we met with President Ghani, the president of Afghanistan, and he is committed to a reconciliation process. He was very clear that his values are long-term peace means long-term security for the Afghan people. But we also have to know, how do we get the Taliban to the table? We're seeing some real violence emerging in Kabul and other parts of the country. And so we still have this balance of a commitment to the region, that people feel like there's still real progress being made. But also, how do we plan an exit? How do we determine and define what will be success for us that means our troops can come home?
Okay. So let's move on to another part of the world here. This is where foreign policy and economics comes together. And I'm talking about China, of course, and the trade war, skirmish. I don't know what you call it yet so far. But are you concerned about how Massachusetts could potentially be affected if indeed the sort of new posture between President Trump and China over trade gets even more intense? If we get into a trade war, let me just say.
Yeah, I am concerned. I think there was some reporting today on an industry we may not think of automatically, but the cranberry industry would be very much impacted here in the Commonwealth. Also in my district, we have lots of small manufacturing facilities that make parts for planes, parts for cars, parts for things that you might not say, oh, Massachusetts will be impacted if Boeing is, or if Detroit and the car manufacturers. But we are often in a long list of vendors that supply to those industries and will be negatively impacted. But I think mainly what concerns me is the way that the president does either foreign affairs, immigration, or now this trade war with China in an impulsive manner. And it's never clear to me, what is the end game? What is the strategy? How does, putting out tariffs on steel, imposing tariff sanctions on Chinese goods, to what end?
Mm-hmm.
And where does the negotiating come in? And what is the long-term goal? And how does that actually get
right.
us towards it?
So I want to come back to this, to your big picture concern in just a second. But Massachusetts really is an interesting state to take a look at what the potential of a trade war could be. Because as you mentioned, right, the cranberry industry is concerned about Chinese tariffs on cranberries and small manufacturers that use steel, et cetera. But on the other hand, the Trump administration administration is doing what it's doing because it wants to protect, you know, American intellectual property from theft from China, essentially. And that intellectual property is the bread and butter. It's the lifeblood. I'm mixing my metaphors now. But for so many businesses and industries in Massachusetts as well. And I just wonder what you think of that.
And I think it's a very valid concern, and one that certainly here in Massachusetts, where we have a real ecosystem of innovation, we want to protect that. And that is something that we have been talking about China and how they operate for a very long time. But it goes back to there may be kernels of good things in all of these proposals. But when it's done over Twitter on a holiday weekend, it becomes hard to see what is the real strategy and how are these different steps taken by the president, often announced on social media, going to get us there. And so while there are parts we all want better protections for intellectual property, I do think there are things that we need to negotiate with China over tariffs and our policies there. But it's disconcerting to see such an impulsive president move forward and then sort of be reined back in by his advisors and others in the White House and his cabinet.
So I'm hearing you say you don't like trade policy by tweet.
That's right. Okay. That's right.
But so, I take your point that there may be small things here and there which you like. But that set against your big picture concerns. But I am kind of curious about some of these details, right? Like, for example, the Trump administration is proposing, still a proposal, but a 25% tariff on a bunch of medical devices, for example, that would be imported from China. Now, this could ostensibly, again, it depends on what the devices are and it depends on the final list of what that would be subject to the tariff. But I'm thinking it could potentially be helpful to medical device manufacturers in Massachusetts, right? You mentioned your district before, and I was looking up Thermo Fisher, Boston Scientific. Right. These are two huge companies based in the Fifth.
Yeah. It's an incredibly dynamic and powerful industry in my district, in the Commonwealth. And potentially, maybe that could help them. But again, I think that what we can't do is take a proposal that doesn't seem well thought out, isn't in looking at a broad trade policy, seems to take the president's own advisors by surprise. Certainly his Republican members of Congress were surprised, and say, you know, overall, I think this is a good idea or a bad idea. I don't think any of us really know. And I think that is the danger about sort of lurching from immigration to trade, to foreign policy, to Syria, without having put out what is the strategy? How are we trying to improve the lives of everyday Americans? And what will this mean for families?
Now, so, I mean, being a Democrat, you're in the minority party in the House here, but we've been focusing a lot on what you think the president should or shouldn't do. But he's allowed to impose these tariffs, right? Because Congress has ceded that power to the president.
Right.
So I'm wondering, I mean, perhaps there's room here for even as a Democrat to advocate in Congress. Maybe Congress ought to pass a law and take that power back.
Well, I think there's a lot of areas where we have ceded great power. One of them, having just been in the Middle East, is the authorized use of military force. We are operating under an AUMF from 2001, and we have allowed not only the current president, but also President Obama we haven't taken up that issue and made that hard vote that is our constitutional responsibility. So I think there are many areas where Congress has actually given great powers to the executive branch, perhaps at the peril of the American people and what our strategy is going to be. And I think we have to look at that and not be afraid to have these discussions and take some of that power back where we are directly accountable accountable to the voters every 2 years in the House.
Yeah, so I'm just looking at some of the laws passed in previous decades by Congress that have allowed the president, and not just this president, but we saw the same thing with President George W. Bush, for example. There's the Trade Act of 1974, the International Emergency Economic Powers Act of 1977, the Trade Expansion Act of 1962. I mean, my point is that several times, there have been several times to what you were saying where Congress has said, okay, let's pass a law that gives the president these additional powers. Would you be willing, Congresswoman Clark, to, again, I get it, you're in the minority party, but still, like, sponsor a bill that says maybe we ought to take some of that power back?
You know, I think that I'm certainly open to looking at that. But I think that what we really need at this particular point in time, that is the state of our law, is for the president to set out a plan. And, you know, what you don't want is to feel that our foreign policy, our immigration policy is being set by Fox and Friends and is sort of an impulsive reaction to what the president may or may not have seen on cable TV. We want to know that there is a strategy, that there is a vision, that he has an idea of where he wants to go, and then we can react as we did, you know, with President Obama as he looked at what to do in Asia with trade and fast track and came to Congress for different votes around that. So it's not so much changing the authority always that we've given the president, but really let's have some more confidence. This is part of a comprehensive strategy. What are those goals and how does that fit into it?
So Congresswoman Clark, if you don't mind me saying, I appreciate what you're saying about needing more consistency from the president of the United States. But on the other hand, correct me if I'm wrong, but somehow my ears are hearing what you're saying, and part of me is thinking, well, the Congress is a co-equal branch of government with the executive.
Yeah.
So why wait for the president to achieve some sort of clarity, which he may never?
Right.
Like, why should Congress wait?
Well, I certainly agree with you that, and I don't want to be misunderstood, that I think Congress has ceded too much power to the executive. And we need to look at many different ways to take that back. If you know, we've done it in the budget. We've done it in many other areas where, you know, the authorized military force, you name it. There are many areas where we have really made a strong executive. And I think we have to, whoever sits in the White House, we have to think about that balance of power. And that's not necessarily just in a Trump administration, but overall, do we have the balance right? And there is a place for Congress that is important because we are elected on a much more community level. And we are held accountable to the voters every 2 years in the House. And that's an important connection. And I think that we have built up a very strong executive that is a dangerous path in some ways. So I want to be clear that I don't think that having an extremely strong executive is a good state. But I think we have to look at it, and not only in terms of what is happening at this moment with the president's latest tweet, but really overall, make sure that we have that balance correct.
You know, my habit is to like really get in the weeds with certain certain bills and certain laws. But I should just take a step back here briefly and say, you know, what are your legislative priorities for this session?
Yeah, well, we are working a lot on the opioid crisis, which continues, even though we have some reason for optimism, some good numbers showing that our death rate is going down in Massachusetts, but it's still way too many people and too many parents that I have talked to, too many funerals that people attend for are young people who are dying of overdose. And we are working across the aisle to focus on prevention, to really look at the adolescent, make sure we have the research to know how we can reach the adolescent who has substance use disorder and find the right treatments for them. We're also looking at seniors and Medicare and a lot of the fraud and doctor shopping we've seen in Medicare. We have a bill to require that they have electronic prescriptions. And at the same time, we know the genesis of a lot of this epidemic came right from the doctor's prescription pads.
Exactly.
So we have a bill that would set up a resource that would be state-based for doctors, because research has shown that over half of the doctors say we don't really know how to prescribe and what alternatives for managing pain can be. And it's modeled after a very successful program we have in the Commonwealth for treating postpartum depression. And we think it's a great model for doing this kind of doctor education.
Yeah.
And most recently, we've been working on a bill that just had a hearing in front of the Energy and Commerce Committee, looking at our workforce and having a student loan repayment program specifically for those who have gone into substance use disorder treatment.
Oh, interesting.
So up to 6 years, we'd pay up to $250,000 in student loans, and that would cover everyone from doctors to recovery coaches.
Okay. So we've just got 2 minutes left here or so, and there's so much we could have talked about. I didn't ask you about gun legislation or anything, but I do want to just kind of wrap up with looking forward to the 2018
yes.
midterms. You're co-chair of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee's Red to Blue program. Before we get to that, though, I think one of the most interesting races in the country right now is here in Massachusetts in the 7th, because Congressman Capuano has a primary challenger in City Councilor Ayanna Pressley. I'm just wondering what you make of that race.
I'm a fan of them both, personally. I am supporting Mike for his reelection, but I also think that Ayanna's run is good for democracy. And I think that she has every right to run. I think she's a terrific city councilor, and I think that she would make a good member of Congress. But I think Mike has really been someone that we can rely on in the delegation. He's got a great progressive record and vote. And I think his seniority on some key committees is going to be very helpful for the country and here in the Commonwealth.
Okay, so I have to ask you, as a woman representative for Massachusetts, I mean, another thing that Ayanna Pressley has said repeatedly is, yes, right, it's good for democracy. There should be primary challengers. But in addition, she sees it as more than that. She sees it as, you know, you need to bring new ideas, a new fresh perspective, a different voice. I mean, we don't have that many women, first of all, in the delegation,
right.
and zip when it comes to women of color.
That's right.
So, could those...
Or men.
or men of color. Could those things actually be more important in the long run for representing Massachusetts than the seniority that Congressman Capuano perhaps brings to Washington?
Well, that's why I think it's great that she's running, because I do think that perspective, that viewpoint is unique to her, and is one that in a majority-minority district like the 7th may really resonate with voters. And I think we have to think about that as we go forward. I certainly don't ascribe to the she needs to wait in line theory. I think that it is good to have that debate. And, it's going to be up to the voters to see where it lands. But I also think that nobody has a dispute in this race with Mike's voting record.
Well, Catherine Clark is the congresswoman from Massachusetts' 5th District. I feel like we only just got started. And look, we went for more than 20 minutes here. So come back soon if you could.
I would love to.
I'd love to have you back. Thank you so much for joining us today.
All right. Thank you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The most comprehensive criminal justice reform bill in decades has passed the Massachusetts legislature. That happened yesterday to very little opposition. Now, law enforcement officials had pushed back hard against some of the original proposals in the bill, but the final piece of legislation seems to strike a compromise between rolling back some of the harshest sentencing minimums and fines, while also cracking down on certain drug penalties and expediting DNA testing in criminal cases. Now, the bill passed 37-0 in the state Senate and 148-5 in the House. Governor Charlie Baker has yet to say if he'll sign the bill, but his office says the administration will, quote, carefully review the final legislation. Now, we spoke earlier with Middlesex County District Attorney Marion Ryan on the compromises made in the bill, and we asked if she likes the final version.
I do. I mean, I was an early supporter of the Senate bill, and I think that what we've accomplished this year is a real testament to the work of the legislature and also to the collaboration across the disciplines. You know, it's important to keep in mind that we do criminal justice reform in Massachusetts about once every 20 years.
Right.
This is a very sweeping bill, and to have it in a place where, as you said, there's pretty much agreement with where we are is a very significant step for the Commonwealth.
You know, I'm seeing here that State Senator Sonia Chang Diaz is calling this a huge turning point for the state regarding criminal justice. It sounds like you'd agree with her.
I do agree with that, yes.
Okay. So I'm curious, though, do you think that the bill does strike the right balance between justice and safety?
I think that those are all, that's always the balance that we are looking to strike, and that folks have worked very hard. Can you always do more? Yes, you always could. But in terms of getting folks together, bringing people to the table, I've been incredibly impressed this year with the really high level of discussion and respect that the players have shown in getting to this point.
Yeah. So is there anything, though, I mean, to be frank, is there anything that's still in the bill that concerns you?
Well, the devil is always in the details. I think that with many of these pieces, it's going to be a question of working it out, of staying on top of things to see that they're actually happening, putting the funding in place to have what's envisioned by the bill.
Okay. What about specifics around things like changes in rules around fentanyl, for example?
Well, you know, the fentanyl piece is obviously the car, specifically with respect to car fentanyl, the bill requires a knowing distribution of a mixture of car fentanyl. So that's going to be challenging. But I think that the piece of legislation reflects the concern that everyone has with the fentanyl and car fentanyl. I mean, that is literally what is killing people right now. That's where we're seeing the increase in fatal overdoses. So we do have to address that, and we'll work through making decisions about those cases and then have them obviously addressed by the court.
Yeah. So one major change that this bill is trying to make is to reduce or in some cases eliminate mandatory minimum sentencing in Massachusetts. But around fentanyl, though, if I'm reading this correctly, it still does have some mandatory minimum. So I'm seeing some people here saying, well, on the one hand, we're getting rid of some mandatory minimums, but on the other hand, we're introducing them from fentanyl. They're concerned that there's a possibility that people suffering from drug abuse may get caught up in the mandatory minimums around fentanyl.
I think what's significant about this bill is we've had mandatory minimums for a long time. This bill goes pretty far in eliminating some of those mandatory minimums. It doesn't go as far as the original Senate bill in eliminating all of those, but it is a sea change, really, in the way people are seeing the difference, as you outlined it, between those people who are suffering from addiction and those who are actually profiting. I think it does reflect the growing concern that folks have and, you know, the families who suffered the devastating loss from fentanyl or carfentanyl. And that is what is killing people right now, you know, literally thousands of people across the Commonwealth. And the decision was to really keep in place those harsher penalties with respect to those drugs.
I'm also seeing here that the bill would authorize DAs to divert people away from criminal sanctions. Can you tell me more what you think about that?
Well, that won't be a big change for us
okay.
in Middlesex and for many other offices because we have very robust diversion programs. This bill does a lot to address some of the collateral consequences for people who get involved in the criminal justice system, addressing their fines or the loss of a driver's license, that sort of thing. But everyone is better off if you can prevent people having to get involved in the criminal justice system to begin with, particularly younger offenders.
Right.
So this really just kind of standardizes what many of us have in place, the diversion programs that help. The goal is to change the trajectory of someone's life, to figure out what the issue is, whether it's substance abuse or mental health concerns or other things, channel them to the right place to get treatment and avoid them being, you know, having the constraints of a criminal record.
So this is a really important point, and it's actually a place in which I think some criminal justice advocates are saying the bill may fall short, right? Because John Larrivee, who's president of Community Resources for Justice, points out, it's a quote from him, on the one hand, we have a criminal justice reform package that's pinning its hopes on the goal of recidivism reduction. At the same time, we've seen programs, including some of the ones that he works with, that focus on reentry close. I mean, is there still something of a disconnect between saying that we want to have a bill here that reduces recidivism, but not necessarily providing the financial supports to help do that?
Well, that's one of the things I was talking about earlier. I mean, I think the challenge for us now that, you know, assuming that the bill makes it out of the governor's office, is going to be how do we pay for this and how do we keep it moving forward? I mean, for instance, one of the pieces that I've been very involved with for the last 4 years that's contained in the bill is the use of restorative justice programs. You know, there's a wonderful result with these programs. They're incredibly important. And this now offers them as an option to folks across the state the same way we do in Middlesex. But that is going to cost money. And, you know, we're going to have to work with our legislative partners to continue to fund those kind of things. Because you're right, having a program in the bill doesn't really change someone's life if we can't afford to pay for it.
And finally, is there anything that you think is missing from the bill or that you would have liked to see?
I think you could always think of things. You know, there were obviously things in the original Senate bill that didn't make it here. But I really think this is a significant moment for the Commonwealth in terms of criminal justice. And it really reflects a growing sophistication in terms of how we look at a number of issues and a real commitment to helping people to move forward from a mistake or something that's happened and get their life back on track.
And I'm just curious, there may be some people listening to this right now who do see this as a soft on crime piece of legislation. Do you think that there's any merit to that, or what would you tell them?
I think that you have to look at this bill as a whole and also look at it against the backdrop of the other statutes that we have in place. And I think that when you look at that and look at how this addresses primarily some of the collateral consequences and what do we want when someone's been held accountable for their actions, the goal is obviously to get them back to work, get them in housing, get them back into society. And this bill goes a long way towards doing that.
Well, Marian Ryan is the district attorney for Middlesex County. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. You're welcome. Take care. Bye-bye.
Let's get another take on the criminal justice reform bill. Joining us now is retired federal judge Nancy Gertner. She's also WBUR's legal analyst and a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School. Judge Gertner, it's good to see you again.
Good to be here.
Okay, so we're going to talk about this criminal justice reform bill, everybody, with Judge Gertner, I promise. But we actually have a little bit of breaking news here also in the world of Massachusetts criminal justice. And that's because the Supreme Judicial Court, Justice Frank Gaziano, has ordered for the dismissal of more than 11,000 convictions in 7,600 cases that were tainted by former state chemist Sonia Farrick. He made that decision today. Folks will remember that Farrick pleaded guilty in 2014 to stealing drug samples and using drugs while working at the state drug lab in Amherst. Now, the Committee for Public Counsel Services, the ACLU of Massachusetts, had called for the dismissal of every case tainted by Farrick and her, quote, subsequent years of prosecutorial misconduct. They called for that last fall. Last month, the CPCS and ACLU expanded their call to include all drug convictions arising from the Amherst lab during Farrick's tenure there. Okay, but today the decision from the SJC is 11,000 convictions in 7,600 cases dismissed. Judge Gertner, what do you think?
Well, it's about time. There was no reason why there were any meaningful distinctions between what had happened in the Boston cases involving Annie Duquesne and this. In fact, in many respects, the Farrick case was much worse because this was not this woman was consuming the drugs, and in addition, it raised profound questions about the workings of the Amherst lab in toto. So, while I welcome this, and it was clear that the court had to take a stand, it's troubling that the prosecutors didn't dismiss more. It's troubling that this couldn't have been done immediately. There was really no other way than to dismiss these cases.
Okay. But the judge also said, the justice, I should say, said that there was prosecutorial misconduct here. I mean, is that something that still needs to be handled?
Well, there continues to be, I believe, a case involving two assistant attorneys general who misrepresented
Indeed.
To the court
right.
about the evidence in the case. And so arguably that's one of the reasons why this didn't happen immediately, because there was misconduct in not disclosing it. You have to step back from this over and over
yeah.
again and say this is not sophisticated DNA analysis. This is not fancy challenges to shaken baby syndrome. This is the de minimis requirements of a laboratory, which is to give accurate drug testing. And the notion that there was any reluctance on the part of the Attorney General's office, on the part of the DA's office, to see this through is extraordinary.
Right. And also, just once again, when we consider the volume of cases we're talking about here, right? I mean, some 7,600 cases, 11,000 convictions today that Justice Gaziano dismissed. In Annie Duquesne's case, it was 20,000, right, that
right.
were thrown out just this past summer.
Right.
So, I mean, I guess what we come back to again and again, though, is can or should your average Bay State resident feel confidence in the criminal justice system, or in the drug labs, at least, in the state now?
Well, I think, it's an interesting question. I mean, one question is there had been an effort to put together a forensic science commission and a commission to oversee all of this, which, as I understand it, is not part of this bill and has not succeeded. So, you have to – the issue is not just remedying what happened yesterday. The issue is remedying it going forward to see what can be done going forward. And I don't know what's going forward, but it seems to me the citizens of Massachusetts should not feel comfortable unless we have figured out a way to prevent this from happening in the future.
Oh, okay. Well, so let's go to the steps forward that the legislature has taken regarding the criminal justice reform bill. Again, just to remind people, it passed overwhelmingly in both the Massachusetts House and Senate. And Governor Baker's office says he's going to take a close look at the final bill, but hasn't yet said word if he's going to sign it or not. But, it's interesting, Judge Gertner, because we heard Middlesex DA Marion Ryan a couple of minutes ago saying that in this state, we only get a reform package like this every 25 years or so, which says something in and of itself. But my thought is then we better get it right if we're only going to do it once a generation. Is this one, did they do it right?
Well, I think that there are a lot of good things in this bill, and I think there's a lot of things to be done. And I hope she's wrong about every 20 years. I mean, I've written about the fact that the irony here is that in liberal Massachusetts, in fact, we were way behind on numbers of fronts in criminal justice, in part because of Willie Horton, who famously killed someone on furlough, and this was in 1980. And to some degree, that horrendous crime shut down criminal justice reform over the next 20 or 30 years. So this is, on the one hand, this is a very important effort, and there are many things in this bill which are really quite remarkable and about time. On the other hand, one would hope that this is not the end of the discussion. For example, there's a section on juveniles 18 to 21.
Yeah.
And there's a study commissioned. The legislature was unwilling to raise the age in which individuals who are accused of crime in that age group would go through the juvenile justice system. Other states have considered that. The neuroscience points in that direction, but they wouldn't do it this time, but called for a commission to study it. Commissions can study it until they're blue in the face. The fact of the matter is that the legislature has to bite the bullet and deal with this age group. 80% of the men that I sentenced when I was a federal judge were in that age group for drug offenses. We have to deal with that age group. It is, on the one hand, the age group that is the easiest to, whose problems are complicated on the one hand, but who in fact will grow out of those problems if we don't mess it up.
Okay, but if in the case of what you saw from the bench, 80%,
yes.
that's the overwhelming majority.
Overwhelming majority, yes.
So what is the right way to deal with it? You're not talking about, shunting them out of the criminal justice system entirely, are you?
No, not at all. I mean, it's a question of understanding, not subjecting them to lengthy terms of imprisonment. It's a version of what the SJC did with, not allowing life without parole for juveniles.
Yeah.
That was under 18, but there's a question in that range as well. What you do can be more, as the fancy word is, criminogenic. You can make them worse criminals by what you do in that period of time. If someone completes a program within that age range, do you want to make sure that their records are expunged? In other words, we know that that is a period of time of change, when the brain is substantial fluidity in the brain, and that there will be changes that you want to make sure you do not make impossible for the rest of their lives.
Okay.
So I would that's a flaw in the bill. I want them to look again at the 18 to 21 year old group.
I see. So because I mean, you wrote an op-ed in the Globe last summer saying that 19 year olds don't belong in adult prisons.
Right.
But this bill, to be specific, it doesn't raise the age of those who count as juvenile offenders to 18.
Right. We were asking for a small step.
Yeah.
The bill was asking for a small step, which was going at least to 19. What they did is they raised the age of individuals who could go through the juvenile justice system from 7 to 12. So you can only charge someone even at age 12, which was a good thing. But the other end they didn't address, and they called for a commission. A commission is a good thing, but there has to be the political will to address this.
Okay. So there's a couple other big sections that I want to talk to you about, because we just spent a bit of time there on juvenile justice. But this idea of changing a lot of the mandatory minimums, minimum sentences, I should say, in Massachusetts, eliminating some, entirely changing others. This is something that a lot of criminal justice advocates have been calling for a long time. But at the same time, we do see the bill have certain mandatory minimums for example, crimes related to trafficking fentanyl and car fentanyl. So I just kind of want to ask you a big 30,000-foot question here. We're getting some changes on the one hand, but new mandatory minimums on the other hand. So does that overall, does that signify to you a change in perspective in the state about whether or not mandatory minimums are the right way to go?
Not clear. I mean, okay. On the one hand, again, we have to sort of look at what's a mandatory minimum. It's saying that judges cannot be trusted to make distinctions with respect to certain kinds of crimes, which does not make any sense. There's an appellate process. There is a transparency with respect to the press as to what judges do. So the notion that you need any kind of mandatory minimums is really quite extraordinary. Plus, there was a problem with mandatory minimums, which is a prosecutor has the ability to determine the sentence by the charge.
Right. So you basically what you're saying is you would like to see mandatory minimums whatsoever.
That's right.
But that is not what we have here.
That's right. But I mean, they eliminated many of them, non-opiate, non-weight retail drug offenses. Many of them were eliminated. I don't think that this is the right response to opioid trafficking, especially given the complexity of opioid trafficking, which is the addicted person oftentimes begins with prescribed medication. The overdoses are oftentimes people sharing drugs, and so you don't know who did what. So given the complexity of opioid trafficking, I would not be in favor of mandatory minimums here.
Okay. So one more sort of major part of the bill that I want to touch on with you, and that is they put the bill writers, the legislature, let's just put them as a whole because it passed with so many overwhelming numbers. The legislature puts a significant amount of effort in trying to craft a bill that would help reduce recidivism rates in Massachusetts.
Right.
And we have a little bit of tape here from Norwood Police Chief William Brooks. He's skeptical that making it easier, for example, for low-level offenders to expunge their criminal records, which is one feature of the bill, he's skeptical that that would have any significant effects on recidivism rates. So here he is.
There's two sides to it. I understand the idea that if a person can kind of get rid of minor mistakes they've made in the past, that it might help them get a job. I understand that. By the same token, we have a very strong Corey law. And most employers don't get a full Corey when they're going to hire someone. So it remains to be seen exactly what impact that has.
Okay, so Judge Gerner, I mean, do you think this bill is going to be effective at reducing recidivism?
I take a page from what Marion Ryan just said. Only if the diversion programs are funded, only if restorative justice is funded. The mistake that we made in 20 years ago before mandatory minimums were in vogue was that we wanted to rehabilitate people and never gave judges the tools with which to do that or correctional facilities with which to do that. It's great to say I'd like you to be rehabilitated, but if you don't have a job and you were kicked out of school in the 10th grade, you walk away from this and you don't have the tools with which to change your life. So expungement is one thing, and I agree with your previous speaker, with Sergeant Brooks, Captain Brooks.
Chief Brooks.
Chief Brooks, sorry. I agree with what he said. The expungement alone doesn't do it, but you really got to work to change lives. And prison obviously doesn't. So what you have to do is other programs, and if they don't fund the other programs, this won't make a difference.
Okay, so last quick question. I'm going over time here, as I always do, but last quick question. You're doing great, Judge Gertner. This
Thank
has
got
to be a million times easier than anything that you faced on the bench here. Okay, but to get back to your earlier point, really, I think a lot of people are calling this a major criminal justice reform bill in Massachusetts because they don't come along that often. But you've already identified several areas here that you wish to see further improvement on. But, I mean, do you have... It seems like a lot of people are just like going, we got this one done. We may not see another one for several years. Are you concerned about that?
Yes, we have to make sure that that doesn't happen. The bill has compassionate release, which is great for older prisoners, which is a wonderful thing. It also does some regulation of solitary confinement, but solitary confinement still exists. So there are good things. But we should not be content until we have real reform, until Massachusetts once again is a leader in criminal justice rather than an also-ran.
All right. Well, Nancy Gertner is a retired federal judge, WBUR's legal analyst, and a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School. And she got away this time without me asking her about Stormy Daniels. So, Judge Gertner, it's great to see you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and hey, it's opening day at Fenway Park, so who cares if it's just chilly enough that Sox fans probably need their hats and their gloves, because the team is riding a five-game winning streak coming into today's game against Tampa Bay. And joining us from Fenway Park is WBUR sports and society reporter Shira Springer. Hello, Shira.
Hello, Meghna. And probably need their hats and gloves? We're talking like 3 to 5 layers of clothing here, plus blankets.
Okay.
It is freezing.
So you're layered up. So you're properly layered up, you know.
Yes.
One would hope that the boys of spring would bring better weather along with them.
would think. And I think they thought it, too, because there's some Tampa Bay Rays players out there with those kind of neck and head coverings that you usually see on ski slopes.
They're like, we left Florida for this? Okay. Well,
exactly.
How's the game going so far?
We are in the middle of the seventh, and it is scoreless.
No.
So, hey, maybe extra innings in the, you know, coming up. Who knows?
All right. So, wow, that is not what I expected to hear. Okay, great. So, good. Sounds like a good game so far. Now, I know you've spoken with some fans.
If you don't like hitting. If you don't like hitting.
Oh, my God. You're such a stickler for sports details here. Okay. But you've been talking to fans today?
I have been talking to fans, and they are incredibly optimistic about this season, despite the lack of spring-like weather. I asked Andrew Sylvia, who is at the park for his 10th opening day in a row, and this is what he thought of the prospects for this year's team.
I think we can compete with the Yankees. The Yankees have a lot of good hitting, but I think we have really good pitching, so... Good pitching always trumps good hitting, so hopefully it'll be a good race till the end, September or so.
You're optimistic.
Always.
Yeah, not surprising. They're playing the Rays, but they're talking about the Yankees. And as you mentioned, 5 wins in a row, but I think the real true test will come next week when the Yankees are in town for a series at Fenway.
Okay, so you know what? The diehard, never say die spirit of the Red Sox fan saying that they're feeling optimistic. That's great, but do you share their optimism, Shira?
I do. I mean, I think, you know, you have a new manager this year with Alex Cora, who's beloved by the fans. He got a big ovation during the opening ceremonies here this afternoon. And a lot of fans are optimistic that he's kind of bring a new attitude and sort of new life into the team, into the clubhouse, which is, I think, something they felt was sorely needed last year. And so, you know, I had some time to talk to fans about the change in manager. And here's what fan Lori Russell had to say.
I love having him. I do. I think he's very good for the team. I think he was a phenomenal player, and I think that the players will listen to him.
And I think that's she speaks for a lot of fans by saying that.
Okay, so what else? We got about a minute here to go, Shira, other than hearing your teeth chatter from how cold it is.
Sorry
there.
About that. You know, my teeth chatter, my nose run. Yeah, that kind of day at the ballpark.
Any other highlights that you've seen at all in these first seven innings of opening day at Fenway Park?
No real highlights because there's no real run. Well, there are no runs on the board, but I think what's been interesting is just how the players have had to try to deal with this weather. I mean, the wind, we talk about the cold, but it's, as you can probably start to hear it, picking up now, you know, 20 mile per hour wind gusts that have just driven the outfielders crazy. It's been kind of entertaining to watch as they think, you know, they've got the ball coming and there's, you know, definite out, and then all of a sudden, nope, it's a triple for the batter. So, I mean, it's been entertaining from that perspective. But hopefully the Sox will get some runs on the board in these late innings, and fans will be spared extra innings. I know maybe in the you know, days of summer when it's nice and warm,
yeah,
they would like some extra innings, but I don't think today is one of those days. I think everybody's like, all right, we've done it, done opening day, let's go home.
All you need is one, right? Exactly.
Exactly, exactly.
Shira Springer, WBUR.
And a good pitching performance.
That would
too,
be good, too.
Yeah, David Price, yeah.
Well, Shira Springer is WBUR Sports and Society reporter speaking to us from Fenway Park on opening day. Shira, thanks so much.
From the freezing confines of Fenway Park.